these important lessons that can be learned only if we cultivate ties with people who are involved in similar struggles all over the globe. And I really want to emphasize that, because I think this is the key at this moment. If we're going to take advantage of this era and move in a forward direction, it has to be based on the kind of anti-racist, anti-colonialist, anti-capitalist internationalism.
That's Angela Davis, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Angela Davis and Ruth Wilson Gilmore on Radical Lessons, Then and Now. The 1960s have been largely romanticized and commodified. The Beatles, Woodstock, sit-ins, protests, and marches. Those years saw huge social change. Bottom-up grassroots movements rocked the establishment. A major symbol of those years was Angela Davis. She has this to say today. The lesson is that even though we don't have the same structures that we had at that time, the challenge is to create a kind of vibrant internationalism. Today, of course, we have the technologies of communication that would enable connections in ways that did not exist at all back then. Angela Davis continues, how to actually begin to create the kind of movements that will bring people in Palestine and people in Brazil and people who are struggling against police violence in France and people who are struggling against police violence in South Africa, how to bring them together. I think that is the major challenge of this moment. Our guests today are two radical elders, Angela Davis and Ruth Gilmore Wilson. Angela Davis is one of the iconic figures of this era. Acquitted on conspiracy charges in 1970, after one of the most famous trials in U.S. history, she went on to become an internationally renowned writer, scholar, and lecturer. She is Professor Emerita at the University of California at Santa Cruz. She's the author of many books, including Freedom is a Constant Struggle. Ruth Wilson Gilmore is director of the Center for Place, Culture, and Politics and a professor of geography at the City University of New York. She's the author of Golden Gulag. The American Sociological Society honored her with its Angela Davis Award. Our moderator is Kianga Yamata Taylor, activist, scholar, author, and a professor of African American Studies at Princeton. The event was hosted by Haymarket Books. We begin with Kianga Yamata Taylor.
Tonight's discussion comes at a critical time. It seems like all times are critical times, but I think now more than ever, after the events of the summer of 2020, which showed the possibility of rebuilding social and political movements to demand and fight for the changes that we want in this society, to the stagnation of those movements and the resurgence of the right exemplified by the events on January 6th in the aftermath of the presidency of Donald Trump. It always feels like we are at a crossroads of sorts, but I think that the perilous condition that we find the planet in, with millions of acres on fire in the West, with nearly 1 million dead in this country alone from the coronavirus, with millions on the precipice of eviction, the crisis in capitalism, the crisis in market economies, and the failure of the political class and the economic elite in this country to offer any rational alternative, continues to open up the space for those of us who think a different kind of world is possible. So I want to maybe, you know, not quite start at the beginning, but I do think that it's helpful when people who are sometimes looked at as icons or, you know, as people who are assumed to have been on the left forever, to really unpack that and to talk about your own process of radicalization. We know that people who are political radicals, socialists on the left, aren't born that way. And so what happened in your path, in your journey through life, that compelled you to look at the world the way in the ways that you do? Ruthie, we'll start with you.
I was born in the middle of the 20th century, smack in the middle, 1950. And I was raised by a father who was an organizer, labor, and community. His father was an organizer, labor. The church that I went to, and this is probably true also of Angela, was a central place where people engaged in the Black freedom movement, you know, would constantly cross paths. There was a lot of informal education, or maybe it was our real formal education going on. So that made me a fighter. There was no question in my mind but that I would be fight. I used to lie awake at night wondering what my purpose was in life, like night after night, in a very crowded house of a very big and loving family. And I suppose it might be of interest to the audience to know that when I decided to become a communist, was not because somebody from the CP talked to me or anything. It was because my geography textbook when I was 12 explained the variety of modes of production, and communism made the most sense to me. So my friend Kathy and I decided to become communists. The rest is history, and that is why they're working so hard to censor education today.
That's amazing. Angela, what about you?
Well, you know, actually, I think I was probably born that way. My mother was active in the Southern Negro Youth Congress, which was a formation that had been created largely by Black communists. I remember that our lives were imbued with this need for change. When I came out of the womb, it was demanding change. In our neighborhood, there were Ku Klux Klan bombings. I could, talk about, what it meant to grow up under conditions of absolute segregation. Birmingham was the most segregated city in the country. Later I remembered that my mother always used to tell us that things were not supposed to be that way. And so, even though I went on to study critical theory, now I realize that my mother had this profound impact on us, asking us to imagine a different world. So it meant that we had to both inhabit that world of white supremacy, but at the same time inhabit another world of our imagination. And not only of our imagination, because it was a world to be brought about through struggle. And then later, when I went to high school in New York, I read the Communist Manifesto. It opened my eyes. And there was another friend of mine in my high school class. And we decided to start calling ourselves communists then. And I joined the Communist Party's youth organization when I think I was about 15 or 16, Advance in New York. And what's interesting is that I also connect that, you might say, prise de conscience about communism with jazz. Mm. Because at the same time we were listening to John Coltrane, we were listening to Eddie Palmieri and salsa in New York. The Cuban Revolution also happened around that time. So it's a long story. It's a very long story.
It's a great story. I'm wondering if maybe you guys could say something about how California figures into your political formation, trajectory, your ideas. Why is it so important? Ruthie, of course, has written, wrote the Golden Gulag about prisons, the buildup of prisons in California. And then Angela has had California as a home base, returned from Europe to Southern California, was, of course, acquitted in Northern California, and then has been there since. So I'm wondering if you guys could just say something about why California looms so largely in your work and political lives.
That's a really good question. And I think for me, so much of it started out as serendipity. And I just happened to move to California when I was in my mid-20s, meaning I went to visit, met a guy and stayed, and I'm still with this guy 46 years later. And then the second thing is that Los Angeles is a place that had all of the contradictions on the surface. You just look around that city and you can see everything always about to erupt or just after an eruption, no matter what, whether you're in a wealthy part of the city or a poorer part of the city, industrial part of the city, you can see all these things. And it was very hard for me not to try to make sense of what I saw through, you know, what I learned through my, you know, political struggles on the East Coast, which is where I grew up, thinking through the kinds of lessons I got, again, to invoke my dad, Cortland Seymour Wilson, who was a labor organizer, a community organizer, and somebody who, although never a member of the Communist Party, definitely modeled for me the kind of being in the world in which you would say to somebody, hello, I'm from the Communist Party and I'm here to help you solve your problems. Not a matter of I know the answer, but I'm here to help solve problems. So seeing the problems, seeing the contradictions, and trying to work them out in a city that concentrates so much of the world. So I think those are some of the reasons why California for me.
You know, when I was very young, a good portion of my family moved to California. My father's sisters and two of my father's sisters and his brother moved to California because California was supposed to be the land of opportunity. Did not have to worry about paying for education. And as a child, I spent a good deal of time in California. We drove across country, and California for me always symbolized possibility. You know, regardless of the fact that there, you know, all of these enormous difficulties. But I'll just tell you a story that I don't often tell. One of my father's sisters became very wealthy in Southern California. It's a strange story. She was in real estate in Birmingham. She actually kind of was a slumlord in Birmingham, moved to California, bought property, and serendipitously ended up making lots and lots of money so that she bought these mansions in Laurel Canyon in the Hollywood Hills. I mean, it's a very bizarre story. She once kicked me out of her house when she learned that I had joined the Communist Party. But of course later, because Herbert Marcuse, with whom I had studied at Brandeis University, he was forced to retire there. They passed some kind of regulation forcing professors to retire after the age of 65. And he went to the University of California, San Diego. And so that is why I ended up in California in 1967, you know, after I had studied for a couple of years in Frankfurt. You know, I still think, I still have, you know, very ambivalent feelings about California, you know, particularly because of the prison work that we've done. But at the same time, I know that there's formations that happened here that probably could not have come into being anywhere else. And I'm thinking about the fact that the, you know, the whole notion of people of color, women of color, is something that emerged out of the particular, you know, socio-political, racial circumstances of California. So I still think of California as providing some kind of leadership. It's where I've lived longest, and I've chosen to live in California. I used to move every 2 years someplace else, but I've remained in California.
So I want to ask another question about this period before we transition to contemporary questions. I do want to ask about this anniversary. Next year, 2022, will be the 50th anniversary, Angela, of your acquittal from charges of conspiracy, kidnapping, and murder in 1972. One of the things that I think is underanalyzed, underunderstood, not talked about, is the Free Angela Davis movement. I say that because when I really started to look at this as a phenomenon of its own earlier in the summer, I was astounded by the size of the movement, which I think globally was something like 260 chapters. And so my question is about, from your own recollections of being politically active during that period, and then Angela, of course, you were the kind of focal point of this campaign, if you could talk about its significance as something that the left can learn from, as something that we should be studying and talking about, as one of the kinds of social movements that emerge from this period of the late 60s and early 1970s. Ruthie.
I have to put in context that the shock of Angela's arrest and the subsequent trial in relation to other events that also drew our lives together, even though we were living on separate coasts. And most notably, it was the COINTELPRO organized murder of my cousin John Huggins at UCLA in January of 1969. That made absolutely brutally present once and for all that the kinds of international solidarity that people like my cousin and the members of the Black Panther Party, people like Angela and people in the Communist Party, people like Cabral and all of those people fighting in for the liberation of Guinea-Bissau and Cabo Verde, people like those fighting for the liberation of Vietnam, all of those struggles were one thing. That is the moment when I went from piecing the things together and trying to hold them in resonance, I was 19, to seeing this is one thing, even if I couldn't talk about it very clearly. So that my cousin's death blew a hole in my heart, as it blew a hole in the hearts of our entire families and everybody who loved him. It seemed almost inevitable that eventually somebody like Angela would also be grabbed by the system that had set out brutally to destroy all who had risen up against it. That said, the struggle to free Angela, which very beautifully named the celebration we had of Angela's papers in Cambridge a few years ago, Freed by the People, was yet again a reminder that the organization of organized people, including pop-up organizations, whether they were the chapters of Free Angela or something else, is the fundamental necessity for us collectively to survive, thrive, and flourish. And this is, for me, the lesson for us to drag through 50 years to this present, and something that I think we can see happening today.
It's remarkable. Angela.
But what I could say about the movement was, first of all, from where I stood, I felt like I really didn't deserve all of that attention. You know, when I was in jail, I constantly thought about the fact that there were, you know, all of these other women who did not have access. So in a sense, you know, I felt, I guess, a kind of survivor's guilt or whatever you might want to call it. And I couldn't, well, Before the end of the trial, I insisted that the name of the movement be not only Freedom for Angela Davis, but Freedom, the National United Committee to Free Angela Davis and All Political Prisoners. But having said that, it was an incredible movement. And, you know, I got pictures, I got visits while I was in jail. You know, James Baldwin came to see me and he wrote this, wonderful open letter that circulated, you know, all over the world. And of course, it was at a moment when we had this vibrant internationalism. Everywhere there was a Communist Party, there was a movement. And to this day, whenever I visit countries for the very first time, I feel the need to thank people. Just before the pandemic, I visited Martinique for the first time. And of course, people came with all of the stories about their involvement in the campaign to free me. And not long before that, I had been in Uruguay, and people in Uruguay were talking about that. So I think for me, the lesson is that even though we don't have the same structures that we had at that time, the challenge is to create that kind of vibrant internationalism. And today, of course, we have the technologies of communication that would enable connections in ways that did not exist at all then. All of those connections were created largely through snail mail. And if we could do that with snail mail, we ought to be able to figure out, you know, how to catch up with the technology, how to actually begin to create the kind of movements that will bring people in Palestine and people in Brazil and people who are struggling against police violence in France and people who are struggling against police violence in South Africa together. I think that is the major challenge of this moment. One other thing I will say, what really moved me was the fact that so many artists and musicians also got involved in the campaign, songs and images. And it made me recognize then the power of art and cultural work. And I think now, during this era, we're seeing this flourishing of art and music for social justice. I'll end by saying, I said in the beginning that I felt I didn't deserve this. Because I was just one person out of the many who suffered the racist and repressive power of the state. And it took me a long time to figure out how to disassociate that movement from me as an individual. And there's a story I sometimes tell about this young woman I met who had a t-shirt with my image on it. And I had tended to feel embarrassed when confronted with something like that. You know, I didn't know how to relate to it. So I asked her, I said, what are you doing with that t-shirt? Why do you have a t-shirt with my image on it? She didn't know a lot about me. She was a young woman in the foster system who was trying to figure out how to go to college. And she said, whenever I wear this t-shirt, it makes me feel powerful. It makes me feel like I can do whatever I set my mind to doing. And at that moment, I realized that the power of the campaign really had little to do with me as an individual, and that I had to begin to think about it differently. It made me realize that the work that I've done over the years, precisely because I have a different kind of a platform based on the attention that came from that movement, that I have to continue to create that kind of movement so that we can, you know, bring down racism, racial capitalism, so that we can demonstrate that the power of organized people throughout the world.
Well, one thing I think just reading about this secondarily is that it did seem to introduce to a much broader audience the problems of prisons, of policing, of the role of the state in creating those conditions of vulnerability for Black people, and then using the police as a way to draw people into the system. And so it does coincide with a kind of what some have termed the turn to punishment. And so I am wondering for each of you, the role of prisons have been crucial to your political influence, certainly to your political activism and work. You were one of the first people to use the term prison industrial complex. Angela, you helped to popularize that term and also the politics of abolition. And then Ruthie, you have been such a formative presence in what is now becoming a much broader audience for the politics of prison abolition. And so I'm wondering if you all could say something about the ways that prison and the criminal punishment or injustice system in this country, why has that become or been a focal point for your political work? I'll start with you, Ruthie.
I would like to share a couple of things. The first is that in the late 80s, early 90s, when the entire planet was going through such huge fracturing and sea change with the collapse, slow but steady collapse of the Soviet Union, the disappearance of Second World for all of the problems it might have had, meant that the last bulwark for freedom movement in the overdeveloped capitalist world was about to disappear. And also the bulwark that to some degree helped to protect the capacity for self-determination in the decolonizing world. All of that was going on. And we were organizing whatever issue had come up. Again, at this point, I was living in Southern California. And it seemed to me and to some of us in the late 80s and early 90s, no matter what we talked to people about, this thing about prison would come up, or thing about a court case, or thing about, it just kept coming up. So we might have been talking about access to education, prison came up. We might be talking about the ability to go pay your electric bill in a convenient way so your lights don't get turned off, prison came up. Environmental justice, prison came up, no matter what. And so it became clear that whatever it is we were going to do, that doing had to in some way involve this constantly expanding brutal threat to people's everyday lives. And given that in this period from the 70s into the early 90s, what existed of the weak welfare state was being very deliberately dismantled and made unavailable, whether for people's security, health, education, and so forth, we saw rising in the interstices of those gaps, prison after prison after prison, police after police after police. And so to summarize where I got to, mass incarceration, not a term we used 30 some odd years ago, is class war. It is that. Capitalism requires inequality and racism enshrines it. So that brings those two things together. Mm-hmm. And then the third piece that fit in, because so many of the people who were doing the justice work, like Mother's Rock, who were women and their children, that if, as Wages for Housework taught me, if women do 2/3 of the world's work for 5% of the income and 1% of the assets, then what we're struggling through and trying to struggle through criminalization is racism and sexism on a global scale. So it's kind of, we're back to internationalism, but dealing with the individualization of disorder, as my friend Alan Feldman put it, that materializes as arrest, trial, conviction, punishment.
You're listening to Ruth Wilson Gilmore and Angela Davis, Radical Lessons, Then and Now. To place a credit card order for CDs of this program, just call us at 1-800-444-1977. Again, that number is 1-800-444-1977. Our special book offer is Angela Davis, Freedom is a Constant Struggle. Written transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are available to you free of charge. Just call us at 1-800-444-1977. Our website, alternativeradio.org. We continue now with Angela Davis.
How can I make this story succinct? I became involved in campaigns to free political prisoners early on in my political trajectory. And as a matter of fact, I ended up going to jail myself as a result of involvement in the campaign to free the soul George Jackson and the Soledad brothers. So I have to admit that during that period, I wasn't thinking very deeply about the prison as a repressive state apparatus and its links to racial capitalism. I have to point out that it was people in prison who turned my attention to this larger question. After I got out of jail, I was really interested in the situation of women in prison, because I had not, in all of the work that I had done around political prisoners and prisons, we had not really focused at all on women as subjects there. But first I wanted to point out that it was because of people like George Jackson and Rochelle McGee that I began to think more deeply about the part played by state violence. Rochelle McGee was the first person I heard referring to himself and other people in prison as slaves. Mm. And it was in conjunction with the 1871 decision, Ruffin v. Commonwealth of Virginia, where, of course, the term slaves of the state emerged, that prisoners were actually equivalent to slaves of the state. I think a plethora of circumstances led to a focus on the relationship between the institutions of the prison and the police and capitalism. On the one hand, anyone who's been active in Black liberation movements has always done work around people who have been targeted by the police or related racist vigilantism. I can almost narrate the course of my own involvement by naming the cases we were involved in. And I was thinking about the other day because we often call for prosecution of the police officer within the context of the existing judicial system. And I was trying to ask myself, why did we do this? Why didn't we realize that we were actually using the same system that produced through its own logic these deaths to try to begin to find some justice? And I think it had to do with the fact that we were considering larger revolutionary struggles, that we didn't imagine that this particular capitalist moment was going to last forever. And that, as a matter of fact, in our own lifetimes, we would experience socialism. Because, of course, you know, we saw what had happened in Cuba and African liberation movements and so forth. But I think that over time, as a result of this plethora of influences, many of us began to think more deeply about the prison as not only as, I would say, a repressive state apparatus, but also as an ideological state apparatus. I'm just amazed that we are experiencing this moment. And you know, Ruthie, you know, we've been talking about these issues for how many years? And there was like a little group of us. And then, you know, suddenly, everyone is talking about them. So it helps us to understand how ultimately movements can influence shifts in opinion and ways in which the public embraces or does not embrace hegemonic ideas. It does prove that what Gramsci said was correct. We can't actually create, you know, we can create counter-hegemonic ideas that then begin to influence vast numbers of people. So I'm really excited because I never expected to be living this moment. I imagined it, but I always kind of compare that to people who were enslaved, imagining freedom and struggling for freedom, even though they did not necessarily expect themselves to experience it.
Well, thank you, Angela. So we're about at time, but I want to ask this last question. I know there are a few specific questions that came from the audience, but I'm going to close out on a question that I think is important. And that is, this year marks the 20th anniversary of the first World Social Forum in Porto Alegre, Brazil, in 2001. And Angela, you spoke some about this earlier when talking about the significance of the Free Angela Davis movement, which is about the power of internationalism. And if there, you know, there are a lot of things that we can say is different about the kind of broadly conceived U.S. left today compared to the period when you all came of age politically. To me, I think the most pronounced difference is the politics of internationalism and seeing our struggles as linked with other people's struggles outside of this country, and really understanding the U.S. as the belly of the beast and feeling a particular need for American radicals, American revolutionaries to play a role in political movements as a result of that. And so I'm wondering if you all could just speak to this kind of new generation of activists who are, and organizers who are coming of age, people who are looking to ideas and politics and traditions to mold themselves. And, you know, I think that is part of the reason why, you know, abolition politics have become so popular, books about racism and what it is and what do we do about it have become so popular, is that people are searching for politics, frameworks, ideas for how to respond to the multitude of crises that we face. And I think one of those that politics that needs to be driven through is the importance of internationalism. And so we've seen internationalism from the right? The way that Donald Trump it's part an American expression of the budding fascist international movement, and the way that some of that coalesced around him. And you know, I think that the virus has shown the ways that we are connected. The climate crisis have shown the ways that we are connected. But we're talking about something more than just sharing a planet and being connected, but about a political commitment to the struggles of other people, and seeing our struggles as entwined. And so I'm wondering if each of you could just speak to the importance of internationalism in the building of a left movement in this country. Ruthie.
Okay. Boy, I could talk about this all night. Absolutely vital. And I'd like to maybe shift where you just left the question to a slightly different register. And that is, rather than think, although it's important to think about activists seeing their struggle in somebody else's struggle, I'd like to emphasize the fact that so many people are struggling across international borders, are struggling through time space in a variety of ways today, which is to say that I think actually internationalism is alive, although it might not be called by that name. And lifting that up, as we have managed collectively to make abolition into some kind of common sense, is a good thing to do. And I'll give you some examples. One, as we know, many of the people who work in healthcare and do care work in general on the Earth's surface are often long-distance migrants. So in the United States, for example, we know that a vast number of people who work as nurses who have been on the front line of the COVID struggle for many, many years are themselves or their children of long-distance migrants, whether from the Philippines or from Sierra Leone or somewhere else. The National Nurses United is an organization that I've been doing some work with. Angela and I presented at their conference last year. I'll do it again next week. Talking with people who are part of the organized labor movement, who are simultaneously working to democratize their union from within and stretch the solidarity across time space from the atomized sites of struggle, hospital by hospital, where union members fight for good working conditions, wages, and protection, to their international reach through Global Nurses United that are in solidarity with nurses in Brazil and in West Africa and so forth. So that's an example, and there are many, many examples. There are examples as well. You mentioned the World Social Forum, of people who have been working very, very hard over many years to hold to account the various members of the investor classes, whether it's TIAA CREF, the retirement account that most of us are somewhat dependent on, or Harvard University, or just big financial institutions that have been participating in land grabs throughout the world and displacing vulnerable people who work in agriculture from growing food that they and communities and people around the world need, and converting land use to monocropping, often for example, ethanol. So, greening is not objectively always a good thing. So Maria Luisa Mendonça, who was one of the founders of the World Social Forum, is today a leader in the movement on a global scale to end land grabbing. So that's another example of internationalism. And I want to say one more thing, because all of these struggles are part of what abolition is. That abolition, in my view, is not the absence of cops and prisons. It's the presence of everything we need to secure that absence and renew and rehearse the world, rehearse the world to make it. So the nurses do it. Vijay Prashad and the Tricontinental Institute built bridges between and among, for example, communist parties that might have had nothing to do with each other 40 years ago, are now struggling together rather than against each other doctrinally in order to secure the capacity for people to engage in their own production, reproduction, and social reproduction. And one last thing I want to say is that while the these latest, electronic capacities for to communicate that's making this amazing conversation possible today are essential. There are also all kinds of more old-fashioned, lower cost, lower intensity forms of communication that my dear friend Elizabeth Robinson, the widow of the great, late, great Cedric Robinson, has worked on again for many, many years all over the world, and that is community radio that enables people to be in contact with each other, low cost, low intensity, low energy, but the possibilities for building solidarity and building movement are really great. So those are just some examples of internationalism today that we can work from and with.
Thank you so much, Ruthie. Angela.
One of the distinguishing characteristics of this era is the rise of women all over the world and the emergence of a kind of feminism that addresses racism and capitalism, anti-capitalist, anti-racist feminism. And we're beginning to recognize that women who have almost always done the real work for movements should be acknowledged as leaders. If one looks at the Black Lives Matter movement, of course, it was women who created that movement. And I was just thinking that we rarely refer to the fact that the Organizing Committee for Critical Resistance conference that took place in 1998, where we were all present, the Organizing Committee consisted of 28 people, and some 25 of them were either women or non-binary. And so it means that we have to, think about not only the role of women, but a range of issues linked to feminism and how they are articulated with these questions of state violence, police violence, prison violence, the connection between gender violence or intimate violence and state violence that has emerged as a consequence of women in prison describing their experiences as being very similar in terms of being abused by intimate partners and being abused by representatives of the state. So I mentioned this in the context of your question on internationalism because this anti-capitalist, anti-racist feminism is emerging all over the world. Brazil, for example, it was Marielle Franco who led the movement against police violence and insisted on a movement against racism, a movement against militarism as key to that campaign against police violence. And in Brazil now, Marielle, of course, was assassinated, there's a wonderful group of radical women in parliaments throughout Brazil now who are radical women, and they call themselves the Seeds of Marielle. I raise this because also I think that when we speak of internationalism, we should not simply be asking for support and solidarity for the movements that we in the U.S. are developing and organizing. Of course, Black Lives Matter would never have emerged in the way that it did without a solidarity emanating from every part of the planet. And I think one of the challenges today is to create the kind of internationalism, and I love the old term internationalism. I think we need to hold on to that. In the U.S., recognizing how those gestures of internationalism can actually strengthen our movements. I'm thinking about how in recent years our developments, our relations with Palestine, our work against the occupation of Palestine has really enriched our movements against police violence. and against prisons. And we've learned a great deal about carcerality, that it is not simply contained in these sites, that it migrates into communities. And these are important lessons that can be learned only if we cultivate ties with people who are involved in similar struggles all over the globe. And I really want to emphasize that, because I think this is the key at this moment. If we're going to take advantage of this era and move in a forward direction, it has to be based on the kind of anti-racist, anti-colonialist, anti-capitalist internationalism.
That was Angela Davis and Ruth Wilson Gilmore, Radical Lessons, Then and Now. Angela Davis is one of the iconic figures of this era. She's Professor Emerita at the University of California at Santa Cruz. She's the author of many books, including Freedom is a Constant Struggle. Ruth Wilson Gilmore is director of the Center for Place, Culture, and Politics and professor of geography at the City University of New York. She's the author of Golden Gulag. This program is produced by Alternative Radio based in Boulder, Colorado. We are independent and in our 36th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. Every week, we feature progressive voices rarely heard in the corporate media, such as Arundhati Roy, Vijay Prashad, Noam Chomsky, Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, Chris Hedges, and Tariq Ali. And we have a series of programs with Angela Davis, as well as her book, Freedom is a Constant Struggle. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. To place a credit card order for CDs of today's program, Angela Davis and Ruth Wilson Gilmore on Radical Lessons, Then and Now, and for Angela Davis's book, Freedom is a Constant Struggle, just give us a call, 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order on our website, alternativeradio.org. Written transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are available to you free of charge. Just give us a call at 1-800-444-1977. Special thanks to Haymarket Books. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening. We go out with Orchestra Marabenta de Mozambique performing Nawahulana.
Money, more, one. ka kanta mabara loko tripele utate kwa mani nwa ulwana omo yo mari yantombi yame utate kwa mani nwa ulwana yeah 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 yo mari yantombi yame utate kwa mani nwa ulwana omo Maria, 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 Maria,